You know, ladies and gentlemen, I've given rather the impression that it's only from Americans whom one actually receives nasty mail, or indeed from Israel's friends in America or Britain. That isn't actually true. I need to point out something that many people don't realize, is that we get attacked by the Muslim world as well. I've been called by Al-Ahram in Egypt, the largest, of course, government newspaper, a black crow pecking at the corpse of Egypt, because I questioned Mubarak's previous presidential victory of 96.98%. I'm still always struck by the fact that the Bahrain newspaper, Akhbar al-Khaleej, after I had investigated torture at the secret police headquarters carried out by a former British special branch officer, and I wonder, Valerie, if I could have your help with this cartoon here, managed to produce a cartoon which shows myself and two colleagues as rabid dogs. There we go. Maybe if one of these mics working, have one of these mics working here, so I could talk into this mic, right. There you go. The BBC is the black dog at the top. My old mate Christopher Walker down here for the Times. And in the middle, the white dog, snapping at all these dollars, is Bob, Robert Fisk of the Independent. And as you can see, we're all rabid. We're drooling. Let's see a bigger picture of Bob here. There's Bob. The nightmare dentures are fairly accurate, actually, but apart from that, the problem is not so much the dollars, if only they did come our way, it's the fact that rabid dogs have to be put down. And this cartoon, which had the full backing of the security services of Bahrain, indeed, of course, they set it up in the first place, is not a joke, it's a death threat. Shortly afterwards, I was banned from Bahrain, but now that the emir is dead and his son has taken over and said that he has to be called Your Supreme Highness the King, and remember that the state of Bahrain is somewhat smaller than the city of Ghent, things have improved. I just wanted to let you know that, you know, there's not a clean bill of health for anybody in the Middle East when it comes to trying to intimidate journalists. I've gone back over and over again of my notes before September 11th. Why didn't we warn you more? Those of us who were living in the Middle East, we had an inkling something was coming. I've gone back, we found one tape of an interview I did on CBC 3 years, almost to the day again, before September 11th. And the BBC, so the CBC interviewer is saying, Robert, why are you so pessimistic about the Middle East? That Israel's got peace with Egypt, Israel's got peace with Jordan. The whole of the Middle East progress is always founded upon who Israel has made peace with. And I said, you're wrong, that the Arab populations, the Arab Muslim populations, are boiling with frustration and anger, and the occupation of the West Bank continues despite the Oslo Agreement. I said, there is an explosion coming. Again, there it is on the tape. I've wound the tape back. I don't know why I said explosion. I didn't. Maybe I meant political, but I don't think so. We knew something was coming. And I felt that bin Laden would only be successful after September 11. If someone, probably Mr. Bush, said that it had changed the world forever, because that would allow the entire Western nations to cut back and destroy all human rights legislation, all prisoners will be unprotected, there will be no further international law applied by the United States. And so it came to pass. I'll tell you my personal feeling. I will not let 19 murderers change my world, and nor should you. But Bush... Bush allowed us to get away with that. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm amazed still that we can't get the Middle East right in our reporting. You only have to look at our coverage, particularly American coverage, of the Arab-Israeli-Palestinian-Israeli dispute. How the occupied territories are now very often in the American press called the disputed territories. How a wall is called a fence or a security barrier. If I put a fence up like the Israeli wall in my garden, I can tell you the neighbors would be calling in the police. How a colony, a Jewish colony for Jews and Jews only, built on Arab land, became a settlement, and a settlement is now often called a neighborhood. And you see, reporters who are frightened of the malicious and slanderous lie that they will be anti-Semitic if they criticize Israel, instead of being called controversial reporters, prefer to choose a form of words, disputed, neighborhood, etc., rather than go in with the reality. But the problem with this is that, and I'm against violence for any reason ever against anyone, the problem with this is that if a child throws a stone at a tank, or a Palestinian fires a shot at a settlement, if he's shooting at just a neighborhood, a nice friendly neighborhood like the west side of Ghent, or the child is protesting about a land which is under dispute, something you can solve over a cup of tea or in a law court, then the Palestinians become mindless terrorists, generically violent people. Who would ever want violence over an issue like a neighborhood or a land dispute or a fence at the bottom of your garden? This, you see, is what we are doing. We are semantically destroying the reality and the narrative of that conflict between Palestinian and Israeli. And this is what, unfortunately, our journalism is now doing. Oddly enough, the American press started the use of the phrase disputed territory immediately after Colin Powell, when he was Secretary of State, told all US diplomats in the region they must refer to the occupied territories as the disputed territories. I was actually in a traffic jam in East Beirut when my mobile phone went, and it was the BBC World Service connecting me with an Israeli government spokesman in Jerusalem, talking about recent events in the West Bank. I, of course, referred to the occupied West Bank, and the voice at the other end said, "Mr. Fisk, it is not occupied, it is disputed, there is no occupation." So I said, "You mean those soldiers who stopped me between Ramallah and Hebron last week? They were Swiss, were they? Or maybe they were Burmese. The UN comes in many colors, but not to the West Bank." But you see, I'm trying to show you the way in which this misreporting, which is quite deliberate, because we don't want to be controversial, or we don't want to be accused of being anti-Semitic when we criticize Israel. I mean, when anyone says that to me in a letter, I threaten them with legal action. It is not true. We are not racists. There are plenty of real anti-Semites out there, and we should all be against them. Not falsely accusing innocent people or trying to tell the truth about the Middle East of being racist. But you know, the other mistake we make is we always go to wars with a notebook in our back pocket instead of a history book. We keep saying we want to give democracy to the Middle East. Sure we do. We always want to free the Middle East. You know, when Napoleon mounted the French expedition in Egypt, he sent out a declaration to the people of Cairo, "We're coming to liberate you from the pashas who hang you when you open your mouth and speak freely." General Sir Angus Maud, British commander, British Army of Invasion, 1917, occupies the whole of Iraq and puts up a declaration on the streets of Baghdad to the people of the Muhafazat, the governorate of Baghdad. I've actually got a copy because a private Charles Dickens of the Cheshire Regiment peeled one off the wall in 1917, put it in his backpack where it became stained by the sweat of the Iraqi summer heat, and eventually gave it to his daughter, who sold it to me for $2,000. And it was framed, it sat close to my desk as I wrote my book. And it begins with the words, "To the people of the governorate of Baghdad, we come here not as conquerors, but as liberators to free you from generations of tyranny." We're always coming with our swords and our guns and our Apache helicopters and our Humvees and our tanks to free the Arabs. What happened? There was an insurgency started against British rule in 1920. Going through the documents, it's like fingerprint parallels to the present. The first British soldier, officer, to be killed was actually murdered quite close to a place called Abu Ghraib. Handari was the actual village. And I know Handari very well because the first American soldier in 2003 to be killed by a roadside bomb was killed at Handari. And I actually went to the scene. His blood was still on the road. And a man came up to me and said, "I'm the grandson of the man who killed the British officer in 1920, and he died just over there." In 1920, in revenge for the killing of this British officer, his name was Townsend, the British army laid siege to a city and fired shells into a city called Fallujah. The British army in 1920 then surrounded a city called Najaf and demanded the surrender of a Shiite cleric called Badr. Not Sadr, but Badr. The British got Badr, the Americans did not get Sadr. In 1920, British military intelligence in Baghdad sent a telegram to the War Office in London saying that terrorists were crossing the Iraqi border from Syria, more or less, yes, that's right. Syria is what they said. And then, because, of course, the insurgency was making the occupation very unpopular back in Britain. We didn't like losing our soldiers. The British Prime Minister at the time, Lloyd George, stood up in the House of Commons and said, if British troops leave Iraq now, there will be civil war. You see, you knew what Lloyd George said, didn't you? You knew exactly what Lloyd George said. I wonder how. I show you the times we live in. The Americans must leave Iraq, and they will leave Iraq, and they can't leave Iraq. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the equation which turns sand into blood. Why? How can we report Iraq anymore? What was the real reason we invaded Iraq? Well, before we say oil, let's go for the other side of it. If the national export of Iraq was asparagus or carrots, I don't think the 82nd Airborne would be in Mosul, and nor do you, nor would the 1st Infantry or the 3rd Infantry Division be around Baghdad. But there's another reason why I think we went to Iraq. Many months ago, I was on Highway 8, the throat-cutting road south of Baghdad, investigating the murder of a poor Red Cross truck driver and talking to a family, Iraqi family, whom I think had probably seen the killers. And suddenly the ground began to shake, and up the road came the biggest military convoy I've ever seen in my life, far outdoing anything I saw of the Soviets, the Red Army in Afghanistan. Truck after truck, Abrams fighting Abrams M1A1 tanks, Bradley fighting armored vehicles, Humvee after Humvee, truck after truck, hundreds of them with tens of thousands of line troops, rifles pointing out of the lorries like porcupines, Apache helicopters overhead all the time. And I realized that 2,000 years ago, a little bit further to the west, I would have been sitting by a roadside, and it would have been the tramp, tramp, tramp of Roman legionnaires, which would have walked past me. And it dawned on me then, a little bit late in the day, that, you know, a superpower has a visceral need to project military strength. We can go to Baghdad, so we will go to Baghdad. We can topple Saddam, we'll get rid of him, and we'll find him in a hole in the ground. And we will take our armies across all the caliphates and the lands where civilization supposedly began. And it was very interesting because last August I was talking to an Iraqi friend in Baghdad who looked, of course, through the other side of the prism. Very strange effect it has. You know, you can go to Washington and hear everything's getting better and believe it. You go back to Baghdad and realize it's worse than ever. Then you go back to London and believe that everything's getting better again. I think you poor people who live in Europe, you know, you don't at least have to go through Alice through the looking glass all the time. But this Iraqi friend of mine said to me, Mr. Robert, can you explain something to me? Why is it that American forces, in some form or another, air bases, special forces, infantry division, barracks, are now in Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, Afghanistan, Iraq, Jordan, Turkey, Israel, Egypt, Algeria, special forces base outside Taman Rasset now in the southern Algerian desert, Qatar, Oman, Yemen, special forces operating in Yemen, still part of Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Kuwait, from Turkey in the north right down to the borders of Somalia, and Pakistan too, by the way. The Americans have their troops across the Muslim Arab world and beyond it, into the Muslim world of Southwest Asia. And you can connect it up from the top. Greenland, Britain, Germany, Yugoslavia, Greece, joining up with Turkey. From the ice cap to Central Africa, there is now a wall, an iron curtain of American military forces. What's it there for? What's on the other side? India, China, Russia. And we don't ask these questions. We are led, the next day of the Saddam trial, it'll be on Thursday. A drumhead court, by the way, because the five judges are all chosen by the Americans, and the rules of the court are, by the way, that Saddam Hussein must not and will not be permitted to talk about his relationship with Donald Rumsfeld and the United States in the years when he was our man, our policeman, our strongman in the Middle East. In Iraq now, there's a new breed of journalists whom I nicknamed hotel journalists. I don't blame them. These are reporters who fly in from London or New York, very often members of television crews. And their security guards, who are, of course, paid for massively by the editors of newspapers and television companies, say, you can't leave the hotel. And most American journalists now just stay in hotels in Baghdad and do not leave the hotel, except to be helicoptered out to the airport from the green zone, this little few acres where the Iraqi government and the British Americans think they're running Iraq. And I don't mine personally, this unfortunate situation. I don't blame journalists who have families who don't want to risk their lives. What I do blame them for is they don't tell their viewers and their listeners and their readers that they don't leave their hotels, that they merely call up on their mobile phones to the Green Zone to talk to American spokesmen, which frankly they can do from County Mayo or Ghent. They don't need to go to Baghdad to do it, but they need the Baghdad dateline. Patrick Coburn on my paper, The Independent, still goes out on the street. So did the Guardian reporter until he was mercifully only briefly kidnapped a few weeks ago. The New York Times still goes out, although the New York Times lives in a stockade with four watchtowers, all manned by armed Iraqis wearing black T-shirts with New York Times written on, American officials say. I get out in the streets. I still go out to lunch in Baghdad, which is truly a principle, a symbol of insanity. But I'll give you an example of what happens. Two bombs in a largely Shiite bus station in the Nahda district of Baghdad in August. Bob jumps in the car with his two Iraqi friends, no armed protection, races to the scene. I get one picture of a woman burning next to a bus. I have 20 seconds interview with an eyewitness and 50 Iraqis beating on the roof of my car in fury and anger, and I jump in the car with my Iraqi friends and race away. Mouse journalism. Run away. Okay, I've got enough there to do 500, 600 words, a little bit of colour, the eyewitness, what I saw with my own eyes. I now ask myself more and more, is the story worth the risk? Is the risk worth the story? I asked myself this during the Algerian war, when I had several of my colleagues murdered. Indeed, one in one case had his head chopped off, just as a journalist has been murdered on video in Iraq. And so the biggest stories, we simply cannot tell in the way we want to tell them, because all we can see is little fragments of the picture when we get out. 10 minutes interview, get away, quickly, go away, because 10 minutes is the time it takes a man outside with a mobile phone to call up men in a car with guns. All of us have a nightmare now of appearing on the videotapes. Bob on the videotape, please, Mr. Blair, withdraw all British forces from Basra by Saturday. Now you can imagine in Downing Street. Poor old Bob, eh? I only wish we could help. It is a nightmare, believe me. It's something I want to avoid really, 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 you know. And the problem is, you see, you can't trust anyone. These death squads, they're not just wandering in from... I don't believe that all the Sunnis are trying to blow up Shiite mosques and all the Shiites are trying to destroy Sunni mosques. You know, the Iraqis are not a sectarian people. It's not a sectarian society. It's a tribal society. I went to the funeral of a doctor, Sunni doctor, killed almost certainly by Shiites because he objected to the building of a Shiite Husseiniyah, a mosque at the end of his street. And after the funeral, I ended up back at the family home for one of these grisly funeral feasts, you know, vast amounts of uncooked meat dropped into your mouth. And I was sitting next to the brother of the doctor, who of course was also a Sunni. So I did the New York Times bit, you know, so will there be a civil war? And he said, Mr. Robert, why do you Westerners always want us to have a civil war? He said, my wife is a Shiite. Do you want me to kill my wife? This is not anecdotal. This is the authentic voice of an Iraqi, right? The first person I ever heard mention civil war in Iraq was Dan Senor, spokesman for the American occupation forces in the summer of 2003. Are we trying to frighten the Iraqis into obedience? Who are these death squads? The Interior Ministry certainly runs some. Who pays the Interior Ministry? Ultimately, us. No, I don't mean the Americans and the Brits are going around trying to sew up civil war, but somebody is. I don't believe, frankly, that Zarqawi is probably alive. You know, he has a wife of whom he's very possessive in the town of Zarqa in Jordan. That's where his name comes from. Now she has to go out to work because she has no money. When his mother died, there were no messages of condolence. Odd from a man who claims, however fraudulently, to be a true Muslim. Very odd indeed. And the more you inquire into this, over and over again, we have people like Margaret Hassan of CARE, who was later executed on camera, on video, was kidnapped by, quote, men in police uniform. Over and over again, we're told men in police uniform blow themselves up during passing out ceremonies. More men in police uniform come and take away kidnap victims. Men in army uniform attack police stations. Are you telling me there's a warehouse in Fallujah with 8,000 made-to-measure police uniforms? So the insurgents arrived... No. The policemen, the men in police uniforms are clearly policemen. And the men in army uniforms are clearly soldiers. They have been totally, utterly infiltrated by the insurgents. I spent a day with a police patrol. We'd go along to the Ministry of Interior. Please, can I spend a day with an Iraqi police patrol in the streets of Baghdad? And horrifically, they said, yes, Mr. Robert, tomorrow morning, 9 o'clock, here's the police station you're going to. So I spent a day with three guys and a Land Rover and a 4x4, pathetically armed, no flak jackets. I didn't have one. I certainly didn't have a gun. So unprotected that they couldn't even have enough petrol, gasoline in their vehicle to keep on patrol. I had to take them to a civilian gas station where they pointed their rifles at the civilians so they could get at the front of the queue, and I paid the independents money to refuel the Iraqi police truck. But the interesting thing about it was that when we started after an hour or two to be very friendly, we're having cups of tea, they stopped referring to the insurgents as the terrorists and started referring to the insurgents as Mujahideen, holy warriors. Then this was interrupted by a radio report that there was a car bomb in the middle of a road, actually very near where the husband of Margaret Hassan, the kidnapped care worker, lives. So we raced to the scene, and there indeed is a horrible, horrible Peugeot with its doors open in the middle of the road. And we all rush around and say, yalla, yalla, to all the people, get out of here, you know, in Fajar, there's a car bomb. And all the people race away, and I'm sort of ordering people out of their houses, and then immediately the Westerner is in charge again. And I looked in the window of the car, and the key was still in the ignition. Very bad news, very bad news. And then, of course, the chief policeman gets a bloody great hammer and starts banging away at the trunk of the car to see if there's a bomb inside. There wasn't. At that moment, round the corner comes a man in a long white galabeer. Stop, stop, I've just been to see the Mohandas, the engineer, my car broke down. Clouds of cigarette smoke go up into the skies over summer Baghdad. Then we continued on our patrol. And then they started saying, you know, the insurgents, you know, the Mujahideen, they're really getting the Americans now. And I realized that as the day progressed, my friendly policemen were transmogrifying into what they also were. They were the insurgents also. They were the same. You know, in Algeria, we used to refer to the faux barrage, the false checkpoints put up by the police, men in police uniform. It took us a couple of months to realize they were Algerian policemen. And sometime around 6:05 in the evening, they became throat-cutting insurgents. Mr. Bush says, oh, we can get out of Iraq. We've got new brigades of the Iraqi army, better security forces. The insurgents whom they're fighting are also the policemen and the soldiers. Big problem. We're not going to get out of there for a long time, unfortunately. How do the, you know, we still don't know the secrets of the suicide bombers. In Lebanon, when it began, we would see one Hezbollah suicide a month attacking the Israelis or their proxy militia, the South Lebanon Army. Then in Palestine, in quotation marks, sorry, it's not a state, it's quotation marks, we would see maybe two suicide bombers in a week. Now we see up to 9 a day in Iraq. My calculation now is that we now have 387 suicide bombers. This is Walmart. You know, there's someone in Fallujah called Mosul. We need two more tomorrow. I think they probably do, you know. We're fighting and seeing something we've never seen before. Iraq is a hell disaster, to quote Winston Churchill about Palestine in 1947. It's gone. It's finished. The only bit we control is the green zone, the few acres of grass and old Republican palace in the center of Baghdad. There are armed men on the streets of Baghdad 500 meters from the green zone. From Kirkuk and Mosul in the north, down to Basra in the south, Iraq is now a place of anarchy, of mafiosi, criminal gangs, kidnap gangs, insurgents, al-Qaeda's members. It is totally outside the hands of the West. The British claim to control Amara. Once every afternoon, they run, with the permission of the local tribal leaders, an armored patrol through the town and scuttle back into their base, close the doors. That's British control over Amara. It's gone. We've lost Iraq. What do we do? Will the Americans talk? Of course the Americans will talk to the insurgents. Not al-Qaeda. The Iraqis will have to deal with al-Qaeda, because we can't. We can't fight them. We can't beat them. We can't stop the suicide bombers. But they will talk to the insurgents. I remember some time ago now, some months ago, going to meet three of their leaders in Jordan, actually, to show you. It wasn't only Syria, Jordan. And the first man who walked in was a general, a former general in the Iraqi army in the Iran-Iraq war. Ah, Mr. Robert, we meet again, he said. I said, I've never met you before in my life. Yo, yes, you have, he said. He said, I led the first tank column across the Karun River Bridge at the beginning of the invasion of Iran in 1980. And you were under fire on our front lines, and you ran out, jumped on my tank, and interviewed me. Back in Beirut, since I don't use email or the internet, I go through all my paper files, and there he is, being interviewed by me, a general. Because the officers of the Iran-Iraq War Iraqi army are now running the insurgency. And the Americans will talk to them. Of course they will. Some of them were trained in America and in Britain, speak very good English. It's not a big language problem. Of course, we never talk to terrorists, like the Americans would never talk to the Viet Cong, but did in Paris. Like the British would never talk to the IRA, but did in Downing Street. And, you know, we would never talk to the Mau Mau in Kenyatta, if Kenya eventually has tea with the Queen. And we would never talk to Aoka in Cyprus, and eventually Makarios has tea with the Queen. We always end up talking to them, and we will in Iraq, and the Americans will talk to the insurgents to get out. And they also need the help of Iran and Syria, which they don't seem to yet realize. That's why I think the conversations have begun, apart from the usual false crisis of Iranian nuclear technology, between the Americans and Iranians, via the Iraqi government itself, which effectively is an Iranian government, because the two main parties, Skiri and Dawa, were actually founded in Iran during the Iran-Iraq war. So we will get out. I think we'll lose, and then we'll declare victory. It's the only thing Bush can probably do. But I don't think we can escape history, and I don't really see how we can go on reporting the Middle East the way we do. You deserve a dose of truth from us journalists. Some of us try to give it to you. Others, I think, have given up. And the power of governments to ignore us increases every day, every day, every day. You know, more than half my mail coming in comes from the United States, and more than half of that mail, and indeed from our other readers, and readers' mail to the editor of the paper, talks about the dysfunctioning of democracy, the breakdown of the democratic process, over and over again. I elect my congressman, I elect my congresswoman, I elect my MP, and they go to parliament and do the opposite. They vote for war, and I'm against war. And I don't know what to tell them. I don't know what we can do. It's not my job. I can say, look, here it is. This is what I see in the mortuary. This is what I see on the main streets. You know, we now have two cases coming up under investigation of US forces lining up men, women, and children and shooting them in revenge in Iraq for the murder of their colleagues. What can one say when one lives in the Muslim world? Every morning I wake up in Beirut and I hear the sounds of the palm leaves flapping against each other, and I hear the waters of the Mediterranean outside my apartment, and I ask myself, where is the explosion coming today? You know, I was 400 meters from former Lebanese Prime Minister Rafik Hariri when he was blown up by a massive bomb, killing 21 other people. I was two trains in front of the tube that blew up in London on June 7th. I was on my way to Heathrow to fly to Istanbul. Is it me, or are we living in a more dangerous world? We shouldn't have to. And I repeat, we shouldn't let 9/11 change our world. Remember that the Sabra Shatila massacre, which you saw on the screen just now, that was 1,700 Palestinians killed, more than half the total dead of the World Trade Center. And no one said that it had changed the world forever. No candles were lit anywhere in the world. And nor did any American president, or any prime minister, or any president from anywhere ever go to Sabra Shatila to stand above the mass grave, which is still there to this day. I'm not sure how I can end a talk like this to you, ladies and gentlemen. It's not a very optimistic one, and I'm not very optimistic. And writing my book, looking back on it, has been a bit of a curse. Maybe it's the story of my curse. I used to think that being a foreign correspondent was a privilege. Now I do think it's a curse. And I suppose the last words I have to say is what I do try to put in all my reporting at the moment. Watch out. Thank you for allowing me to talk to you today.